let's aim for 90 minutes. I won't clock Coco, I won't put, you know, but like still, let's aim for 90. But yeah, you can chat about stuff. We can start. I won't just say hello, whatever. Hello.
It's Nola, new thinking. You are being pretty ambitious if you're thinking that you can
Oh yeah,
drop it within 90.
I had this amazing idea, which amazing also translates to being cringy as fuck, is that we can begin with khatam and then start with
No, exactly. You stole my
hello.
words. You stole my
No.
words.
We are
You
not
stole my
that
words. I
talented.
was
We are
just going
not
to
that
say.
talented. I am sorry. We are really not that
Or we can release this podcast in a backward style.
That too will be too experimental, I
Yes.
think.
I mean, this guy loves to experiment. He is going to drop
Just chop the
bombs this
podcast into
time.
like bits. यहाँ पे कुछ है, वहाँ पे कोई सेंटेंस है, वहाँ
No, let's begin with khatam na, and then we can go
Yes.
wherever.
Good
I
night,
improved this
guys. Good night,
basically.
guys. It's been a pleasure to
Thank you
talk to
so
you.
much for listening,
Yeah.
and if you want to
Yeah.
follow
See you
us,
in the
you
next
are.
episode.
Yes. Okay. So hello. Welcome to today's podcast. If you are staying with us after our terrible joke, then we are here meeting for the first time to discuss basically a three-part series on Christopher Nolan, the director who has the most fandom in the world after Marvel, I guess, and DC,
Yeah.
whatever. Like he's one of our blockbuster auteurs, I think, alongside, I think he's the only one who's
He's
sort
the
of
only one.
left.
He's the only
Quentin
one.
Tarantino is the other one who I know makes films, and they actually make money based on just his name. Spielberg's passed that ship, and then Scorsese's films don't make money also.
More
So
like a brand. More like
yeah,
a
so
brand.
it, definitely. But I mean,
Yeah.
I would say mostly a brand. I like also like anyways, we'll so the voices you are hearing, it's we are beginning with like a chronology already, I feel. Anyways,
I hate the fact that I use that term. Anyway.
yeah, but that's it's a comment, whatever. The people who are there in this episode and might reoccur and reappear in the other ones, changing on like depending on which ones different decide to like drop out and like drop in. So the first one we have is our regular Amartya Acharya, who initiated this episode along with me, I feel. And we both will
There
probably
is
be
an
there for.
irregular Amartya Acharya also who is not coming into this episode, but anyway.
Okay. Yes. Then we have Varun Bhake, who appeared with us in the Fablemans episode and the Noir episode before. So he is returning to discuss all things Nolan. And we have a new guest with us also, Prithvish Roy, right? Correct.
Yes,
Yes.
Roy.
Okay. Because there are so many names, I'm just taking notes on Nolan things. My mind is a jumble already, I feel. But Prithvish is joining us for the first time. Prithvish, would you like to introduce yourself, please, to our listeners?
Okay, so what kind of introduction? It's like a
Any
backward
what? Give me
introduction?
no,
Not
like
backward, backward. Let's see how
not
much of a genius you are.
backward.
Backward. Okay, it's been a pleasure to talk to you all.
Yep.
I studied in I'm currently pursuing MBA and I did chemical engineering, but my passion has always been for cinema ever
Yep.
since I've been a child.
Yeah.
So and my exposure to Nolan, like to be very honest, my exposure to international content has started from Nolan, like
Yep.
any other Indian nerd guy who's like and it obviously started from the Nolan Dark Knight trilogy.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to join in the podcast to discuss about films and shows, and thanks to Amartya.
Oh,
He
absolutely. You should tell
yes,
us.
kudos.
I mean, we'll be happy to have newer people, newer perspectives. That's always been something that we
And
like to
I
jump
would
on.
love to be a part of this community from
Yeah.
here on. So
Our
yeah,
pleasure.
and
Absolutely
yeah,
a pleasure.
and
But
yeah.
no, but
So
you set
there.
us up well in the sense of this whole idea of, you know, Nolan being someone who I think for most cinephiles, like at least people who are into films outside of Bollywood now. Or Bollywood or Indian cinema in
People who are
general,
not
sorry.
cinephiles as well,
Yeah,
all of
exactly.
them have watched, all of them have has watched Nolan
Yeah.
films. And that's why I say Christopher Nolan is not a director, he's more of a brand,
Yeah.
because Oppenheimer जो स्टार अट्रैक्शन है वो क्रिस्टोफर नोलन ही है.
एब्सोल्युटली
He's the star of this film, not Cillian Murphy or anybody. Because when that from Christopher Nolan that title card shows up in the theater, it erupted. Like, so I'll tell you one event when I watched Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 last year, last month. It was in Hyderabad, so I watched and like it's actually called the tallest screen in Asia. It's called Prasads. So when the Oppenheimer trailer showed up, people are so crazy over there. They cheered on every other actor. And they cheered the even they even cheered for Matt Damon, who has no superhero background or anything. They were so crazy for him. And they cheered the most when the name Christopher Nolan showed up. So I think, yeah, it goes back to for all of the people. And also it ties up to the fact that Christopher Nolan has made three remarkable movies about one remarkable comic book character. So it has been the Bible for all the nerdy superhero fans who got introduced to their
Amartya's
love.
lifting his
Yes.
hands up in joy.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So yeah.
No, but that's very true. And I feel now, unfortunately, with greater fandom comes greater toxicity. Is that a new
Toxicity,
motto?
yes.
Maybe I will
Are we
go for
going to
that.
get into the Nolan toxicity now,
No,
please?
but there is,
Please
right?
let us
So
not.
we are not discussing it because we are discussing mainly his films, and our first three selections for this episode are his first three films, which are sort of very much before the time he got into big sort of, studio cinema in many senses. And the three films we've decided to exclude from discussion of all our things is actually the Batman films. It's not being superhero bias or whatever from my end. It was just a conscious decision on the fact that we can only record a number of episodes.
Believe me, if it was superhero bias, I wouldn't be joining this
Yeah, exactly.
podcast
Amartya could alone handle the three Dark Knight, three whatever Batman
anymore.
films.
Yeah.
Anyways, the point is that we want to discuss his other films also. I think his first three especially are fun to discuss because I think they are in some ways or the other the least discussed, the least seen even. I feel at least Following and Insomnia are the least seen. Memento has gained a enormous cult following. I feel deservedly so. And yeah, we want to discuss those films today. And I think we would love to see more like sort of engagement, even from the listeners on the end of which films of Nolan did they sort of, start grab. Like, I think which is the introduction is probably, as Prithvi said, is the Batman films. I feel those sort of allow people a gateway into his other work. But I feel so much of his work is otherwise linked. And I think it's expanded because of the other blockbusters that have become popular, Inception, Interstellar, all of these, which we are going to be discussing also. So I think, but humble beginnings, I think, and we begin with his first film, first narrative feature, sorry.
Your eyes drift across a crowd of people, and they slowly stop and fix on one person, and all of a sudden that person isn't part of the crowd anymore. They become an individual, just like that. Just became irresistible.
So you followed women?
I followed anybody. I just wanted to see where they went, what they did. It was supposed to just be completely random. You would never follow the same person twice. That was the most important rule. That was the one that I broke first. That's when the trouble started.
I got burgled yesterday.
What's it feel like being broken into?
Following, which is his 1998 feature, it's on Criterion Channel if anyone wants to watch. It's on other places also, and it also has a linear cut, which Amartya
Yes.
reminded me of, which I need to
Which
watch because.
Varun saw that Varun's reaction was hilarious. Varun is like, why? Why
There's a
did you take a linear cut?
linear cut of Memento also, which I
Ah,
think
there
is
is. That I know
pointless,
about.
which I
Yes.
think will be pointless.
Okay,
But
I didn't know
anyways,
about this. I didn't know about this. Where is
no,
this
but
available?
the
It's
linear cut
available
for
somewhere.
Memento, I probably is with a Blu-ray or something. But Amartya
Okay.
said that the linear cut of Following is available on Criterion itself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How Arun,
But
you say?
this linear cut of Memento is very much like that time when Ted Turner's company was doing, all those colorizations that were not authorized and
Yeah,
stuff.
exactly.
Just
Just to
It's
sell
like
more.
that. Yeah. It's Because there
completely unnecessary.
no, they're like you have the YouTubers, right, who will explain even the most basic of films. They're like, let's
Yes.
listen to an explainer of,
Bye.
a rom-com.
You don't need an explanation.
You are describing my job.
You're not a YouTuber. He didn't mention that.
You're not a YouTuber.
I'm just saying, you're basically describing my job.
YouTubers out there are describing the end of Fast and Furious 10. What are you talking about? A franchisee where everybody dies and comes back.
Yeah.
To be fair, to dampen down the whole Nolan ka also, Nolan's films, this is my, I guess, recurring criticism. I think everyone's will be. His films explain themselves a lot also.
Yes.
But anyways, we are going to Following. Following is our, and this is, Amartya, we forgot to mention, but this is also Noir part two, right? Our
exactly.
episode we did on Noir, because all three first films of Christopher Nolan are essentially noir variations in some sense.
Which is also something I miss, honestly, now this current Nolan, because if you see his three films, I think if you are a noir lover, you will actually realize that how much of a lover of noir he really is. Because while watching Following, the two filmmakers who I was reminded of was unsurprisingly, one was Hitchcock.
Yeah.
The other was surprisingly Kubrick.
He's had it. Like, I think Kubrick has had a big influence. I mean, 2001 has, and that's in Interstellar. You see the block.
No. I think Kubrick, because if anybody has seen Kubrick's The Killing.
Killing.
It's got a similar vibe. I've seen
Yeah.
You have these lofty comparison. I was thinking of Darren Aronofsky's Pi because of its grungy look.
Similar time, apparently
people said that Aronofsky was the more gifted filmmaker out of that entire batch.
I really like Aronofsky's films, except The Whale.
Except The Whale, yes.
But anyways, not to Aronofsky, but so basically Following, for people who aren't familiar with the film Following, is about... I've written snarky plot descriptions for all three of them. So can I read those
please
out?
Please
go with the official line. So, okay. You mentioned Hitchcock. So Following is a loner writer, Rear Windows his way through dark and dilapidated London, only to find out that he's the one being rear windowed by the one he is rear windowing.
I did not expect this to go full porn, but okay.
Anyways, officially, the film is about a young writer living in London who basically is a voyeur, and he tries to look into people's other lives to find sort of inspiration for his novels. But it becomes an obsession, and he gets entangled in this whole mystery, which he didn't think he would ever get entangled in. I think it's a very sort of classic premise, almost, of like what you would get of, again, Hitchcock is, I think, the greatest.
It's extremely Hitchcockian, yeah.
Yeah.
Extremely Hitchcockian.
But what do you guys all think of it? Initial thoughts. You can start with Varun, and then we can go. I know, because Varun mentioned to me that he's a big Following fan. So
I discovered Following during the first lockdown, so 2020, right? And it was everybody's rating for Tenet, and then he's like, you know, I won't release the film just like that.
Oh yes.
I was like, yeah, let's then catch up on the work that he's done and we've not watched.
Yeah.
And I was surprised by how much of, you know, it's got a sort of razor blade, Ustra, the barbers.
Yes, yes.
It's got that kind of vibe, you know. It's very sort of, I'll cut you, I'll do something like that. It's very much that sort of geographical location.
Fighting cynicism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that because at that point I'd not seen either Memento or Insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
So I was more used to sort of Nolan's work being set in big places and stuff like that. The closest that I thought Following came to another of his works was The Prestige, parts of Victorian London. But the fact that he would take such an innocuous sort of character and a setting and do something, do his, you know, time thing again. In fact, now that I think of it, it reminds me of a little of... also, Edgar Wright's first film, A Fistful of Fingers. So, essentially, both filmmakers are trying out the tricks they have become famous for.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like taking a well-established genre and trying to add their own spin to it.
Yeah.
And Following is sort of, you know, it's also very entertaining, but it's very funny in places.
he's, you know, he was at least, I'm not sure is, but at least he was a pretty funny writer. At least in Memento, he's very funny.
He's very funny, yeah.
But
yeah, I think he became more self-serious or portentous later on. But yeah.
Okay. I think the self-seriousness is there kind of consistently.
Yeah, yeah. But the portentousness came much later, right? Because all of his blockbusters carried an air of self-importance anyway. Which, granted, you have to. But you get the idea. But yeah, it's... I think
Amartya, you go ahead. And then Prithvish can...
I think... my liking for the following stems more from the inspirations, because you can clearly understand that this guy loves noir. He loves it. He absolutely loves it, and he loves British noir. There's a clear sense, right? Not just because of the language. There's a clear sense over the, because that Kubrick comparison is very, very, very apparent. And intransigent amount of shadows, you know, the shots.
He shot it, by the way. That's the only film of his, I think, he's shot, like, at least in the narrative features.
The shot of doors and everything. So all of that, it makes me realize that, you know, how much of this guy, and also his observational skills, because it's very much grounded in Nolan trying to explain human condition to you. And he's also very expositional in a way, because his dialogues are very wordy. You can see it here also.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's full on, like, full what on. Is my film about? Let me tell
what
them.
Is my film in, about? In what am detail. I doing? Yeah, yeah.
Over eager, I thought. Like, over pretty eager, over almost, eager.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Which is fine if you can write it down well enough.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't feel exhausted. It actually feels funny, because it's like, okay then. I mean, sure, man, you are arrogant, but you get the idea. It's like a character.
He's calling out the guy a fair bit also. Like, the weird thing is, the young man looks a bit like Nolan.
Yeah.
Like, with his hair falling Bob, right? out, especially. Yeah, if you've seen a Nolan photo, and like, if you see the actor who plays him, I'm like, I'm pretty sure he modeled it on himself.
I think it's almost like he's calling himself out, which is great. Nolan being self-aware, that's nice. So you get the idea anyway. But also, like Varun said, because he's a first-time filmmaker, any first-time filmmaker would like to put his own stamp, right? So the stamp here is the stamp which he's trying to put everywhere, and which is always going to be his interest moving forward in each and every movie of his, playing around with time. So you can play around with time either from a narrative sense or from a screenplay structure sense. Here he's doing it with a screenplay structure sense. It's a question whether it works or not. I don't think for me it works, because it feels completely unnecessary. But that experimentation is there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the narrative chosen needn't require that, but the experimentation is still there.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating in a way. Which is fascinating.
That's a good description of it. Prithvish?
Actually, the one thing I was going to say, Omurtada already said that this guy loves noir. When I first watched Memento, I mean, back in when I was rewatching his film for Dunkirk, that's when I got introduced to Following. And one thing I noticed, one significant thing that made all of his three films very restless is the quick cuts he had in one particular scene. He had very, very restless cuts in between just one particular scene, like a man keeps one knife and then he takes another gun and he keeps and replaces all the bullets, does that evidence in bullets in Insomnia. I noticed this one scene, and this is evident in Following as well. He, in one particular scene, there are at least 9 to 10 cuts. And it's like, it's going to like, it's done. I can feel the effort he has, the meticulous effort he used to do in his films. He used to be on a very, very grounded level. And it feels like a student film who is like very passionate for films. He wants to root for the genre he always loved for. So I think Following is a good homage to his introduction to his journey as a filmmaker. And I think I don't have much of too much opinions or anything significant to talk about Following, except the editing thing. And also the way he shot the films, like the frames he captured there, it felt very claustrophobic.
Absolutely.
It felt very, very claustrophobic. Just
yeah.
like Varun said, it's like, it's just like, it reminded me so much of Aronofsky's Pi.
Mm-hmm.
It's so grungy, it's so claustrophobic, it makes you feel not really good. And I was actually feeling uncomfortable watching Following, because for a guy who has watched, who's, when I think of Nolan, I think of larger than life, science fiction, gimmicks and extravagant films.
Yeah.
But for a guy who is making a very grungy noir films,
yeah.
which it's kind of making claustrophobic,
yeah.
and alongside the editing and the framings he has done. So yeah, I think it's good. It's a decent film. It's a decent start for his filmography.
I feel it's very much, it feels a little bit like a first film, which I think is not even a problem that much. Like, I mean, I think my Amartya kind of voiced my main problem with the film is the structure of it feels very much like, you know, you can see the filmmaker putting his stamp by showing you how he's putting his stamp rather than melding
it's
that.
It's not
which,
effortless. It's
which
not effortless.
He will do, I think, in his next film. But in this, it feels very much like I might have actually preferred the film if he took a linear approach, which is why I was like, I might need to watch the linear cut. And I mean, because I feel sometimes, you know, the narrative structure restricts the sort of characters in the film. Like, they feel very much like pawns. And this is a common criticism of his films, that there's an emotional sterility to all of his films, which I don't think I buy in, because I have some exceptions to it, like some major exceptions to it, I feel. So I think that, regardless, I mean, it feels like a solid homage more so than, you know, what I think Varun also said about Edgar Wright. I mean, I think this is a better film than Fistful of, I think Fistful
definitely,
of Fingers.
Definitely. Fistful of Fingers.
Like,
you can see that wooden horse at one point.
Yes.
They can't conceal that.
Yeah. The
Fistful of Fingers
is
very, very amateurish.
Uh-huh.
It's very
it's very funny in the way that a young Edgar Wright would have been.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But also here's the thing, right? Like Prithvi said, that editing, like you can understand that this is a guy who is very interested in doing that. Like his editing, why am I saying that he's playing with time? Because when he's doing those restless editings, you can see that he's doing those restless editings in a specific scene.
Yeah.
It's like he's playing with that scene. He's playing with perspectives of that single scene. You can see that, and then you will see the movie where he exactly perfected that scene. That movie is The Dark Knight. There is a scene. The score playing during that scene is called aggressive expansion. That scene is when the Joker actually enters Bruce Wayne's apartment.
Okay.
The party is happening. He's entering the apartment. The car comes. The judge's house. The car explodes. You know, card showers.
So is this
everywhere.
Basically like a parallel editing thing?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
He perfects it in Dark Knight, because if you watch it in Dark Knight, it's immaculate.
Okay.
Immaculate. The score is playing perfectly. The editing is done perfectly.
Got it.
You see that here, you will realize that he's doing it. I think he reaches it almost in Insomnia. In that last scene, there is a...
There is a wonderful...
I get what you mean.
Yes, but regardless, I mean, I also want to flag up David Julian's score, which I really liked in Following.
Yeah.
And didn't notice it the previous time I watched it.
Reminds me of Dunkirk.
Ah, exactly. Like, David Julian did pretty solid work, I think, in this and Memento, Insomnia.
Yeah,
less crazy about. But David Julian's score, like, there's this traditional, you know, when Nolan's films have that string, that long string sort of noise to it. Like, it's like contemplative, like the character's thinking, and then the sound sort of goes like that. And then there's this...
discordant noise. Like,
I love the discordant thing in this, like where it's like almost like a train is breathing up and down. It feels like that, and it's very like, again, adds to the claustrophobia of it. But I mean, I think it's very difficult to talk about this film without sort of saying, being like, you know, damning it with faint praise almost, I feel like, rather than anything else. Because one of the things I noted was that there's that eagerness to tell the audience about what he's thinking, which also sometimes translates to arrogance, because Following can also mean that, you know, are you following what I'm doing?
Are you following what I'm saying? Yeah.
Which I'm like, I am. So I don't need to have like that condescending attitude.
But then again, you realize that this is a student film, right? At the end of the day.
Yeah.
So inherently that arrogance is always going to come, right?
Because absolutely.
When you're creating a movie, you're always the smartest guy because this thing came out of your head. Not realizing that other people can understand it. You know?
Yeah.
You need to chill out.
No, I mean, because see, this film has so many, it has the whole idea of voyeurism, the whole idea of, you know, breaking into someone's life is very, I mean, I find it fascinating. And like, I think
it's the home invasion.
Yeah, right? But the whole idea of breaking into someone's life, I think, is there. Like, I feel I've seen films in which when you do that, you really feel, you know, yourself being like, you know, emotionally challenged or moved by it.
And I feel in this,
that's very scattered. Like, that doesn't feel whatever.
It's a violation in a way. It's a violation in a way, right? If you're going in, if you're doing a home invasion, it's more of a violation. There was a Bangladeshi film which came out 2 years ago, I think, called Januar or Animal. It's horrifying. I mean, you can say that it's a very shock-exploitative movie, but you know, that was like a horrifying look at what home invasion can actually do.
Got it.
But yeah.
I was thinking more on the level of that sort of conceptual, you know, how I mean, in Inception, he's breaking into people's lives. And I remember it having a bigger effect on me.
Yes.
I've seen this documentary called The Imposter, which I recommend to everyone all the time, which is about breaking into someone's life. And the way the director plays with time there, you kind of are conned into thinking the way the conner is conning the people. So that's the sort of level of, you know, in immersion I feel you can get when you get really confused or caught up in a narrative, which I think is lacking in here. But again, it's the first film thing, which you can see it. And I mean, if you want to understand what his films are about, as we've explained, that it's about time, but it's also like, if you want to understand, it's about voyeurism. He says he was born a peeping Tom. All the things he kind of always tells you what it's about. Like, I think if you've seen enough films, you start to get a hang of.
Of course, the Powell and Pressburger.
Yeah, I was thinking, is that a Powell and Pressburger homage?
But I mean, I'll weigh in here about what you guys are saying about the narrative. I found that, and this is what I felt after first watching it, because I'm not one for rewatching films. I very rarely do it. And in fact, if you notice my letterbox, I didn't rewatch.
Okay. I rewatched Insomnia the third time, and I'm 100% sure if we discuss it another time, I'm not rewatching it. So.
But I felt that, you know, the denouement here, which is the big reveals, so to speak, if he had done it linearly, I don't think he trusts his craft enough to be able to convince the audience at that point. Because it's actually, if you think about it, it's a very Abbas Mastan kind of...
Yes.
That kind of thing, you know?
I detest that comparison, but yes.
I mean, they would do it well in a campy way. Yeah. They would do it well. They'd
listen,
it well.
Abbas Mastan, I also like, but doing it well isn't the group of words I would use.
Race is interesting. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, somehow I thought you were going to bring in Ghajni Varun. You brought in Abbas Mastan.
Nolan could have done it better if Following would have been a very campy film. Because Abbas Mastan did, they are experts at doing campy films.
So I think because it was slightly more, like you said, self-serious. He's treating it with a lot of, with a certain lens of intellectualism. He's like, okay, let me try this trick. Even if it's not perfect, it hooks people in.
And because I saw the linear edit though, because I saw it and I genuinely feel that, you know, that reveal that Cobb and his wife are actually within it, because it's a linear edit, that reveal happens in the middle only. So after that, what you are doing as a viewer is you're just waiting for the car crash to inevitably happen.
The bomb under the table sort of thing.
Yes,
the
exactly.
Hitchcock principle, basically.
Yes. So I felt that if you remove that entire time ka experimentation, it will become even more of a Hitchcock thing. That would work. That's all I'm saying.
That's very interesting. I mean, I would love to watch the... It's also 1 hour long, or whatever, 1 hour, 10
minutes. 70
minutes. Before we got into bloated Nolan runtimes. Even though...
Yeah, I think his leaner films are in that sense, at least, Because for me, then again, Dunkirk is what, 107 minutes?
Yeah.
1 hour 47.
One of his shortest films, yeah.
Shortest studio film, that's it. Yeah. It's in fact shorter than Memento. It's shorter than Memento.
Yeah.
So I think it's his second shortest film after following it's got to be Dunkirk. And
good news for Oppenheimer, Varun. It's supposed to be 3 hours.
Yeah, it's 3 hours. That's okay. I mean, it's 30 years of Oppenheimer's life.
Yeah.
So, or at least 20 years. But it's also like, you know, why do you have to be? But it's that Indian principle of, array, if I'm paying 250 rupees, the movie should be 3.5 hours.
I think it's more like indulgence. It's become
absolutely. It's like I must make sure
I can cover all of it.
Showing on, like, you know, on screen. It doesn't make sense.
It's also almost feels like, you know, the director buying into his own hype.
Why won't he?
Take a Fincher. Mm-hmm. The hype about him has not really changed his filmmaking style in that sense. He's still doing the sort of films he wanted to do.
Yeah.
Albeit,
I feel
like,
Nolan's,
you know,
just upsized, no, but in many senses. So you have to change that. Like, your approach will automatically be a little different, I feel.
And
so.
Also, So I was just saying that also the fact that he's blurring out the line between practicality and extravagant thing, because he crashed a plane in Tenet. Now he also buys into the idea of meme marketing.
Yeah.
How Nolan's films have become a meme, how Nolan's directorial techniques have become a meme. Yeah. That is also
I sincerely hope he does not buy into his marketing too much and literally destroys a city using an atom bomb, you know, at this point.
I think that whole what you're saying, Prithuj, about the whole publicity side of it. I mean, even it's weird that Amartya and me are actually in this episode, considering he's the cinema guy and we are we are not anti-cinema, but we are the least concerned about cinema experience.
We both are.
I don't really like. I don't think cinema experience defines a film. Is my point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The theatrical experience.
Yes. The theatrical, which Nolan is all about, and I feel it's over inflated.
We are missing our co-host here. The one guy who
two co-hosts, both of them kind
both
of.
Both of them.
But I mean, if his theatrical experience thing is a bit of an oversell, because the way he's shot Oppenheimer, a handful of theaters, even in the States, only a handful can show it.
Yeah.
In the way he shot it. So if your technique is so expensive that theaters are like, no, boss, we'll do without it.
Yeah.
No, and the weird thing is, I've actually seen his whatever he assumes are his whatever films that can only or should only be watched. I watched Dunkirk on the smallest thing on a plane and it blew
me
out. So like, I'm like, boss, it works here also. Just saying, like, you
I was done with an interval, so it still worked.
India mein.
Indian Indian theaters are always with intervals.
Yeah.
On the weirdest point, I watched when I watched Tenet on the big screen for the second time. The interval was just when the chase started. During that. When John David Washington was going to rescue Elizabeth.
If I saw it in the theater, I would have clapped. I was like, oh, khatam ho gaya.
Tenet insult number two. Which is a good reason for us to move on to Memento, just to light things up, I feel.
Yep.
But see, after watching Insomnia, because I wanted to make more sense of Insomnia, and because I was like sleepy, I basically was starting to connect these films, you know. So I was like, if Following is about experiencing betrayal and like whatever, experiencing sort of the betrayal from someone, Memento is basically wanting to live in in the web of betrayal or in the web of lies, because that's more preferable, I feel, to
Memento
the
is Memento is solipsism. Memento is constructing a reality which you want to live and you don't want to escape. Not understanding what the outside world actually is and not accepting.
But I feel even the outside world sort of cons you when you kind of want to be conned.
That's
because
that's the cynicism, right? That's the ultimate noir cynicism. People recognize that this guy is always going to do it. So let me use him.
Teddy, don't believe his lies. He is the one. Kill him. I finally found him. How long have I been looking?
Find anything? Didn't think so. Let's go, huh? Oh, fuck this.
You're gonna pay for what you did. Oh, beg forgiveness, and then you pay.
Let it. You're a clue, you freak.
Beg my wife's forgiveness before I blow your brains out.
Leonard, you don't know what's going on. You don't even know my name.
Teddy.
That's because you read it off a fucking picture. You don't know who you are.
I'm Leonard Shelby. I'm from San Francisco.
That's who you were. That's not what you become.
Shut your mouth.
You want to know, Lenny? Come on. Come on, let's go down to the basement. Let's go down, you and me together. Then you'll know who you really are. No!
The film is about, for whoever's not aware and whoever's not seen Memento, can you please go and watch it? Like, I mean
they have watched Gajini, so they know.
No. Absolutely not.
Guy Pearce is taller. And he doesn't dance to Behka Behka.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, the only thing I didn't like about Memento that it didn't have Tu Meri Adhuri Paas.
And also, Guy Pearce did not have an 8-pack.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. You know,
I like Prithvish that you said it didn't have that Javed Ali song. I was like, it doesn't have Pradeep Rawat. I mean, what are you going to do without Deva? You know?
Come on, guys, you could have ruined Following and Insomnia. You didn't have to ruin Memento.
How could have we ruined Following with stalking Bollywood songs which romanticize stalkings?
Yeah, you can't actually ruin Following. I think people will look at Following and they'll be like, hey, is movie mein kya hai? Ye toh
exactly. Karte hai.
Literally every Vela Nikala type dude.
Exactly.
Oh God. Okay.
Isse achha toh Asur bana diya. Isse achha toh Asur mein achha thriller.
Jesus fucking Christ. Really that show now?
These references have unplanned all of them, by the way.
Gajini was planned.
I like Arsene's whole comedy track with Aamir Khan. I don't mind at all. Anyways, Memento is not comedy at all. Actually, it is comic. It has a lot of comedy.
It has a lot of
black comedy to it, but. Yeah. But it's not a romantic revenge thriller, which it was made into with Gajini. To me, it's about memory. Like, basically, the whole film is about memory. And it's one of the most, I think, expert ways of conveying, like, how slippery memory is and how much it's a mixture of fact and fiction. And how, actually, fiction, you know, the whole saying of fact, fiction is often born out of fiction. It's like almost a reverse of that. Like a fact is born out of fiction or something like that. And it's such I think this is the marriage between form and content here is, I think, unsurpassable, I want to say, but I don't want to say that because I want to rewatch his other films and give them the chance of being better. Anyways, the film is about Leonard Shelby, an insurance investigator who suffers from retrograde amnesia.
Insurance investigator, because of
This is a bracket double indemnity.
Double indemnity, because of course.
Yeah, he suffers from retrograde amnesia. Something even Shah Rukh Khan, I think, does in Jab Tak Hai Jaan. Since you guys have already ruined it all, we can just add other whatever instances.
He has two accidents in there.
Yes, exactly.
You want me to ruin it even more? Even Kim Ki Sasbi Kabhi Bahut Hi Meher had retrograde amnesia. Let's move on now.
I mean, every character has this. They get hit once, they forget all the memories. They get hit on
hit
the
again,
same spot.
They will remember all the memories.
They remember all the memories.
It's me again. Is the
like a TV ka remote.
Oh god. Anyways,
he
suffers from amnesia, but he uses notes and tattoos to hunt for the man he thinks killed his wife, which is the last thing he claims to remember. So guys, I know we all love Memento. How much do you love it and why do you love it so much is basically the place to start. Prithuj, you can start with you and then we can go.
Okay. But so the thing that goes without any sayings or any other, what do you say? I'll just get straight to the point that my favorite Nolan film till date is Memento, has to be, because even though he went on to stretch out this idea of this complex narrative into some extravagant films, the most Memento, I think, is his most honest execution in the way he always wanted his stories to tell, because as I said in the beginning, it's the most accessible, and also Amitabh said, it's the most accessible Nolan film. So the way he branches out the narrative style, he makes it very, very convenient for the audience to understand with a scene. That scene starts from the beginning. When it starts from the beginning, the scene also ends at the beginning, the color ones.
Yes.
It also ends at the end with the same sequence, just to make the audience understand that it started from there.
Yeah,
but it didn't happen in the other films.
There is a clear demarcation, right?
There's a clear demarcation in Memento, and I think that's what makes Memento my favorite Nolan film, because I think what Christopher, like as I said, his directorial trademarks or whatever it was there, I think the most authenticity was portrayed. I think it's the most in Memento, and apart from that, like. Performances in his films didn't really account for me much, but even keeping aside that factor, the actors did really well. I mean, even though that Teddy guy, he went on to become a bit caricaturish in the end, but the editing and the sound designing towards the end, how he concluded that film with the philosophy that we all need mirrors to reflect, to remind of ourselves and everything. I think he reminded the idea of self-reflection and self-identity in the most conjugal way possible. So I think, it made me... So it's. I think it's that Nolan film that made me understand all of his frames, all the scenes without being too caricaturish.
Without looking at an explainer.
Yet being complicated, looking intelligent, intelligently edited.
The editor is Doddy Dawn, who's edited, I think, to this and Insomnia, the previous ones edited by Nolan himself. So
he also had a character named Dodd in Memento. So I think there's so
many names in Memento, actually. I always confuse them. There's like names flying around, like five, six.
I remember because so amongst these three films, Memento is stuck with me the most.
Because
it's the most remarkable film, and in terms of editing or storytelling, what you might say, even the characters, the way they are being staged, the way they are being mentioned. So Dodd, there is one scene where this actor, Carrie Ann Moss, what was her character's name? I don't remember.
Natalie.
So Natalie enters the room, she gets hit by Guy Pearce, and then she again enters, she says, Dodd hit me. Dodd bit the shit out of me. So I remember then he kidnaps Dodd. So I remember all these characters. Then there was Sammy Jenkins and all this. Teddy was there. John Ritter, Edward Gammell. There was a lot of playing with the names as well.
John G.
Had a lot like of different sort of John G. John Edward Gammell. Sammy Jenkins.
Sammy Leonard. What is it like?
Leonard. Sort of variations, Lenny.
Teddy.
Lenny. Teddy.
Of course, the Femme Fatale's name in this movie is Natalie.
Yeah.
Of course it is. It's like, you have to name it like in some sort of a Russian seductress fashion. You have to name it Natalia or some shit like that.
Yeah.
Because of course you have to do it.
The photo of hers is also like shadowy, like everywhere. Pantoliano character basically says that what have you like Leibovitz, like you've taken the photo like of
And of course Teddy is played by Joey Pants, one of the most exaggerated actors alive. You know, that's a compliment, by the way. I love Joey Pants. Get the idea. And also,
he was brilliant in Sopranos. He was brilliant.
Oh yeah, season two, man.
Absolutely brilliant. He killed it.
Yeah. So you get the idea, and I think this is the closest crystallization of the noir genre, according to Nolan.
Mm.
If anybody thinks that this is not noir, let me remind you that the forward timeline is literally in monochrome.
Yeah.
It is black and white. A phone rings and he's talking, he's expositioning, and even the backward timeline is having a voiceover by him. Every second, the backward timeline resets. He's like, okay, what am I doing now? I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And I'm like, so each and every single time, a short film resets itself.
Yeah.
Each and every section works as an individual short film.
Yeah.
But I'm still curious about how the plot line of Sammy Jenkins gets incorporated into this film. I don't want to think about that plot line. I just want to think about only Leonard's black and white and color events. But I'm still curious about how Sammy Jenkins got into this thing. Like, what is the significance of Sammy Jenkins and his character.
I think Sammy Jenkins is basically his manifestation of his own guilt. He's like projecting it into another character.
It's a story. Yeah, it's a story constructed, basically.
The original Sammy Jenkins was the con man.
Yeah.
We don't know what the original Sammy Jenkins was like. But
yeah.
The Sammy Jenkins of the story is basically his guilt manifestation.
Yeah.
He's projecting his guilt into another character which he can blame. Similarly, like the blame he posits on the person who actually legitimately did a harmful thing on his life and completely destroyed his life.
Yeah.
That action is the only thing that is driving him now.
Hmm.
So each and every time he's checking that Sammy Jenkins incident, he's using it as fuel again and again.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he wants to live in that reality because if he doesn't live in that reality, what else is he going to do? He's going to face the actual reality, which is that his wife is dead, he has nothing to live for, and he's literally just a walking, talking vigilante who is shooting people named John G.
Yeah. He's exacted his revenge, right? In many senses.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I mean. I think this is the more sort of heartbreaking part. I mean, I think it's a heartbreaking film in general. Like, just there's a devastation, emotional devastation in the idea that you have to tell lies to be happy. Like, it's as simple, which is also explained in the film, which I still think
we
is
all
a
lie
bit,
to be happy. Yeah,
we all lie to be happy. It's kind of like, is the whole
you did
thing.
Not need the line though. That's my whole point. It's like,
you don't need it. It's all sort of already expressed in ways which is pretty amazing. But I think one of the things that struck me this time was, you go after this, please. That struck me this time at least was that. That he goes to Teddy and I think he tells him, I've lost my train of thought. How appropriate. Varun, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah.
This wasn't even, I genuinely did lose my train of thought.
I like to think of Memento as an interesting, because it's thought of as a thriller and as a noir film, and it is all those things. I like to think of it actually as a very interesting city film.
Mm.
I like how for a thriller, for instance, it takes place mostly for large parts in the daytime.
Yep.
Uh-huh. There's so much, and it's actually fairly bright film. There's a lot of like white seeping in constantly. Mm. It's like, you know, if you didn't know it was by design, you'd be like, does this guy not know how to shoot?
Yeah.
You'd be like, there's just too much light bleeding into the frame. Mm. And the idea that, you know, Los Angeles can still be this town of seemingly few people.
Mm.
It's not popping with color.
Is it in LA? I'm not sure the location.
I think it's
a bit
is
lost.
Is it in LA though? I thought that it was in Detroit or something.
Okay, not
I have
sure.
a feeling it was LA.
Okay.
But regardless,
at that point,
at least the American city film was about, you know, popping colors and vibrant stuff, even if it was dark.
Yeah.
Even if it was like you had LA Confidential just a couple of years ago.
The mundanity of a modern American city.
Absolutely. Exactly that. And it sort of reflects in the kind of clothes he wears. He's again dressed a bit like Nolan. You know, he's constantly wearing those suits.
Suits.
Oh, yeah.
Gray suits, and blue shirts.
Light blue shirt, yeah.
Plus Guy Pearce, but yes. Yeah. Like a lot of things.
Also, if you notice one thing, Guy Pearce wears a gray coat and a blue shirt, while Teddy wears a blue. Overcoat and a gray shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like there it completely symbolizes the fact that it is going in reverse.
And they are opposites also, like they are basically sort of finding each other. I mean, Varun, you continue. I will say what I thought, and now I might have realized.
So yeah. I like the fact that the film gives you a chance. I don't like the films that are like, hey, you know, caught you. Trying to do something, you give your audience a fair chance.
Otherwise, it's like the Leonardo DiCaprio meme and the single jack.
It's like Agatha Christie, ki sabne ek murder kiya hai.
Yeah, sabne ek murder kiya hai.
Which is just... Spoilers. Spoilers for Murder on the Orient
Express. Murder on the Orient Express,
So, it gives you that chance and it allows you, and like both Prithvish and Amartya pointed out, it's a film that's fairly sort of, you know, you can tell what's happening. Mm. You just need to, like, you know, follow the trail.
Following,
following the trail. Follow the film. So,
but it's also like a jigsaw puzzle, which is also linear, right? It's just reverse linear. It's just reverse. That's it.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's enjoy. It's also, you can just call it a staple thriller and pretty much enjoy it.
Yeah.
You don't need to necessarily be joining all the dots, and you know, it's fun in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more fun if you join the dots.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also be like, you know what, I want to watch a Panic Room kind of movie.
Mm.
You put on Memento and you'll still enjoy it as a film.
No, this time, I think this time, much more than sort of previous watches, I watched it primarily as a sort of, you know, I'm not going to look to join how one thing fits with another. And the whole film just played out much more like a haze, like memory, I guess. Like it felt hazy. Like, you know, you are overwhelmed by details flying at your face and you kind of just accumulate them in a sense where you are like just lost in a similar sense that the character is.
That's the design, right? Because each and every time the protagonist is telling, okay, what do I have now? I have a wine bottle in my hand. I'm sitting here.
Yeah.
Walls are green.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. All that
I'm chasing him. Oh, no, he's chasing me.
Yeah, the details are basically resetting him, right?
Yeah.
Setting him, grounding him in a way, just to, you know, so that his memory can recalibrate again.
Absolutely.
It's also like information overload on the viewer, except if you're logically thinking, you are already placing the jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel it's very much like even what we talked about, how in Following, the structure sometimes felt like an aberration, right? It felt too much of an imposition. Here, I feel he is trying to order this like super, super like precisely, but it still finds ways to be super chaotic. So like, it's like perfectly encapsulating like the memory itself. Like it feels so like, I mean, you talked about the flashes, right? Yeah, in Following, the cuts, how they happen within scenes. In this also, like there's these momentary flashes of his wife, which feel like they're like just burst onto the scene rather than sort of, you know, be arranged or organized by him. So again, it's such a like brilliant mix of both of these sensibilities. Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, yeah. I think that's something Nolan would lose later on. No? Mm. Instead of those bursts, like, you know, he'll show you one
frame. He will prolong it.
So you see it in pretty much all his bigger films. Inception.
With the wife's subplot.
Everywhere you shout Mal,
It just keeps going on and you're like, you've lost that impact.
That elusive nature of what it used to be, you kind of just...
I think the film where it works is probably Dunkirk, because he just cuts out
there's no flashback.
He cuts out any and all emotional connection to Dunkirk anyway. It's like you're just watching it.
I don't know.
That's not a criticism of the movie. Yeah. I love that movie. I'm just saying. Yeah. That's not a
criticism. But even so, like when he uses the flash, not even the flashes, for instance, when he shows the when he shows Tom Hardy finally land at Dunkirk Beach, he lets that play out, but there's very little narrative sound. The sound is all Zimmer's music.
It's all so within it the scene, right? Like within
it
one
doesn't
individuated
like
what
they pointed out. If he does it so much in Inception and then in Interstellar, it just, and even in the Dark Knight Rises after part, you're like, man, this movie's interminable.
I love that movie, but
negatives later. So
yeah, but it's in Memento, you realize that using it sparingly, not necessarily in terms of how often you use the technique, but how you're using it in itself. What packs a punch.
This is also the place where I invoke my Terrence Malick reference. I think
God.
is
Please,
influenced
please,
by
please,
him.
please. I am open the door, please.
He
go
is influenced by him. I'm not, this is not even like me reaching. He is actively a big fan of the Thin Red Line. So the flashbacks.
I never said you were reaching. I'm just saying doors open, go ahead.
I know, but वो है I, my point is that like the whole flashes of the past, like the impressionist angle of it feels very much from what a Malick,
Yes,
I mean
yes.
he
Yeah.
Malick film
But
kind of
Malick
thing.
mimics it in The Thin Red Line. Like Ben Chaplin reading that letter is such a ham of a scene.
Oh
You
boy.
feel for him.
No.
You feel for him,
Opening a
but
wrong
no.
wrong can of worms here, Varun. We are going to get to
Not
an argument.
the
That film
episode.
changed my
Not
life, so
the
I can't hear. I'm kidding. You
episode.
can
Not
say
the
bad things
episode.
about
Not the
it.
episode to do that, yeah.
Yes. Or not in front of me. You can criticize him as much in front of other people. I kid.
I think
Nahi,
a
but
perspective, I think what struck me this time while watching Memento, by the way, I watched it almost a decade later. So,
Wow.
oh yeah, I'm old, guys. Anyway, so
We are
दो
also greater than a
दो
decade year old. ऐसे कोई 10 साल की एज नहीं है
डेकेड्स में तो हो ही कोई
अपन.
ऐसा
Yeah.
सो नो द थिंग इज दैट व्हाट आई सॉ एट दिस पॉइंट व्हाट स्ट्रक मी दिस टाइम वाज देयर इज अ वेरी वियर्ड सीन राइट दैट ही hires an escort and he just tells her to arrange a couple of things so that and slams the door so that he wakes up. When I saw that the last time I had seen that movie, that scene didn't even register with me. This time when I saw the scene, I realized that that was the whole point of the movie. He doesn't want to escape this cycle. He
He
wants to
wants to stay in
remain.
it.
He
That's
wants
the
to
first
remain.
scene also, no? Yeah, I mean, we discussed the how great the first image is of him
Yeah.
shaking
Of him
the
shaking it.
photo,
Yeah. Yeah.
and the photo rather than forming it blurs out. He
Blurs
wants
out.
to
Yeah.
blur it out. He
It's
wants to
like
blur
it's almost
his
like
reality out.
it's almost like self-flagellation, right?
It
Because
is.
it is self-flagellation. He doesn't want to escape it because that is the only thing that is giving him purpose.
Order. That's what it gives him.
Order.
Like
Yeah.
that's a circular order. I feel like
It's a
almost like
circular order. Yeah.
and then you're trapped in it, but you kind of feel liberated by it because
And
that's the
every time,
only way you can live your life.
I'm bringing a computer reference here. I can't believe I'm doing this. So every time he's resetting it, it's like a computer without a cache memory, right? Because every time you shut down a computer, your RAM memory is erased. Every time you turn it on, your RAM takes it from the cache memory and then reboots it. So what is happening this time that every time a loud sound or 15 minutes have passed, his memory is automatically getting reset. Except this time there is no cache memory. That is why there is no new memories for him. So that's both a hindrance for him and also a relief for him.
It's I feel it's more like by the end I feel it's much more like the weird thing is where he writes on one of his photos. Like it can be taken in two ways. He writes on the photo with Natalie that she is the one who's also experienced pain and she will be the one who will help you.
Out of
In
pity.
the weird out of pity, in the weirdest possible way, she does help him because she manages to make him kill the one person who wants him to investigate himself and to
Yes.
reveal the truth. And the thing he does to do to him is basically kill him so that he can essentially reset his cycle again.
Yeah.
It's like I just think like the more you sort of delve into the machinations of the plot and the way it's constructed, you kind of I find it hard to like shake off, which I think is the whole
One of the
appeal of the
best
film.
one of the best Jonathan Nolan stories, one of the
It's his
best
short story, right?
It's a short story.
one of the best of Jonathan Nolan's stories, one of Christopher Nolan's best screenplays. One of his best
Absolutely.
screenplays.
I'm actually wondering if, with the entire way in which the film ends up playing out, that he wants to remain in this thing, if it's actually a point about comfort in life, right? Which is, we are so comfortable in a certain reality and in a day-to-day of it, that even a reality that is not necessarily very pleasant, but we are accustomed to, is
It's order.
something human as a the human being as a creature of habit or repetition would be like, yeah, okay, fine, bring it on, because you can do it all over again.
There's certainty now, I think.
Yeah.
But there's certainty about the fact, about a horrible fact that your wife
Yeah.
is dead and
Is
you've
it?
still not attained justice.
Yeah.
Like that's the horrible thing I feel, but you're still sticking to it because that's the only way of going through life. Like, it's such a sad way to look at life, but it's what the film conveys, I think, very heartbreakingly. I feel this is my answer always to people who think that Nolan films are cold. I feel this film kind of just passes that boundary for me, at least. Like, it does
this,
make me...
This film is tragic in a way. It's full on tragedy, called as cold also. It's extremely cynical because, he's like a rolling stone. He's like a stone, He's like rolling down a hill at this point. And all these people who are surrounding him, they are seeing the stone and each and everything. They're just cutting through the path just a bit so that the stone can shift and just destroy any of the things which are stopping their lives.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
Like, he's like a force of nature. Let's just, point him in this direction.
Yeah.
He will solve our problems and let him go about his merry way.
Absolutely.
That is heartbreaking.
Yeah, and the fact that he's happy being that almost after a point, because it's like that's the way he will live his life. Otherwise, how will he?
That is heartbreaking. That is also terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm wondering if the cynicism in his films and the films of his that are emotional are also the most emotional are also the ones of his that are the most cynical. There's this, there's The Prestige, where there's multiple deaths happening and stuff going down and. To some degree, I'd say that of The Dark Knight as well, because you've got an emotional hook to both.
Well, I think a lot of people like Interstellar, right? I mean, I like Interstellar plenty.
It's not cynical, though.
No, it's very romantic. Very saccharine. No, that's why I was wondering. Like, I mean, I know people like Interstellar.
I think that's the exception to his emotionality, so to speak. Because even Dunkirk, what happens failure. Is that it's a failure.
Yeah.
Dunkirk's evacuation basically just saved the British army.
Yeah. Yes.
And the idea was then, now we have an army to fight a war.
Yes.
You still had 5 more years of war left.
Yes.
So, there's no real victory.
It's basically stopping a police action to get back to the war.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I'm wondering if that has, he's more sort of he's more...
Cynicism has more depth.
Nolan films are they are tragic without emotions, without like on your face emotions.
The Dark Knight is also extremely tragic.
It is. And it's doubly tragic, right? It's personally tragic and institutionally tragic.
Because the truth doesn't, that's why it's also emotional, because the truth doesn't matter all the time. The people deserves more.
Yeah.
That's
because Dent lets you down more than anyone else. Dent lets you down so badly in the film.
And
you're like, everything that he's the figure of hope and all of that jazz just comes crashing down.
You guys are welcome to record an episode on the Batman series, by the way. If you wish.
Rises ki baat karni padegi, koi problem.
Rises ka baat main kar dunga, issue nahi.
Anyways, anything more, guys, on Memento before we move on to what I think is the worst Nolan film?
I don't think it's his worst.
Same.
Anyways, I wanted to shout out. Also, do you guys also think that Guy Pearce looks a lot like young Brad Pitt? Right? It's not just me.
There's a similarity there.
Guy Pearce is basically young Pierce Brosnan.
More like
interesting.
Pierce
I just thought he looked so much like like he's inspired by him, and then he basically is less cocky. And
jaw structure with other cuts in between.
Reminded me a lot like him.
Guy Pearce should have been a superstar at this point,
And his wife looks a lot like Daisy Ridley. I was like, what alternate universe is this I'm living in? But it's clearly not Daisy Ridley. So
Guy Pearce was set up for superstardom in the late 2000s. Memento, he had
LA Confidential.
He's the guy who gets beaten up in Prometheus. I remember him as that. Or like gets his head sucked out.
He has a very strong supporting role right now in a recent miniseries I'm watching. But
He's the love interest in that. No,
The Clearing.
Achha,
there is a show I'm watching called The Clearing. It's an Australian cult TV show. It's quite good. But
Insomnia, Alaska. We'll go to nicely Australia. To door ki baat hai.
brought him in to solve an unspeakable crime.
Detective Dormer, it's such an honor to meet you. I'm Detective Ellie Burr. Welcome to Nightmute.
So incredible to be working with you. The Leland Street murders was my case study at the Academy.
Someone out there just beat a 17-year-old girl to death. Your job is to find him.
Doesn't say in the report that he clipped her nails. He washed her hair.
No mutilation?
Not this time. He tortures him, makes him do things, and keeps him there for 3 days.
This guy, he crossed the line, and he didn't even blink.
Police!
What Detective Dormer doesn't know is that murder is only part of the plan.
Insomnia. I'll be snarky about it. So
I can be snarky about it also. I'm more snarky about the original than the remake.
So that's why you do the honors. I'll be nice. No, I'll stay out.
No. So a pair of detectives are basically sent to investigate a murder in a sleepy, because this is the Nolan version, the sleepy Alaskan town.
Yeah.
The gimmick of the movie is that the town has perpetual sunlight because there is no sunset.
Yes. Guilt looms large.
Yeah. And all that stuff. Yeah. Snark kaha ghusaoge bhai? Aise bhi
guilt, bhai, that's the, listen, the idea, this is there in the original also. So the original one, version, 1997 version, Scandinavian noir, version, beginning of Scandinavian noir, I think.
Yeah. Bad beginning, by the way. Well, let's just move on.
Yes, so yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. But now, the two police officers, one is played by Al Pacino, the other is played by, I exactly don't remember.
Matthew something.
He's in other Nolan films.
Only. Martin Donovan.
He was in Tenet.
I remember him the most in Ant-Man because Michael Douglas broke his nose. That I remember.
I don't even appreciate that, but okay, that people remember him from Ant-Man, but okay. during an investigation into the murder of a young school teenager, while chasing down the suspect, Al Pacino's character, who is our protagonist, shoots his partner by mistake.
Yes.
And apparently the killer, the person who is being chased, the killer has actually seen this event occur.
Yeah.
So now the cat and mouse chase begins, in which Pacino's character has to both solve the case as well as ensure that the blame doesn't fall on him, that he has murdered his partner. So that's the cat and mouse chase.
Yeah.
That's more or less the basic plot of the movie.
That's very well summarized also.
Sounds like every HBO miniseries.
Every HBO miniseries ever, yeah.
Every thriller Hollywood was making in the early 2000s.
I'm guaranteeing you True Detective Night Country will also be the same thing.
Exactly.
Except perpetual sunlight is perpetual darkness.
But it is one of the films which will just not age well because of how much proliferation of like this type of film and show we have now, I think. Right? Because I think there's just so much that I'm like, I watched this 3 times now and I'm shocked I watched it 3 times.
I don't know why.
Because I don't remember it, Amartya. It's not very good. So I need to refresh my memory of it.
I get it.
Memento reference.
You don't remember it. Memory.
Of course. But there's not even like memory slippage in this case. I don't remember the movie.
Very forgettable film, honestly.
I'm going to put this through, but honestly, I would like to bring up the original because people are really shocked that I don't like the original. And my point is that Scandi noirs are dry. That's the basic conceit of their whole thing. They don't have a loud background score. Okay. They don't have that much of dynamic camera work to the extent that, you know, you are going to be slackened at every of the scenery, because that's not the point. The juxtaposition is already a given.
Yeah.
Great scenery, but the murders which are happening are equally heinous.
Yeah.
That's a given. I get it. But my issue with Insomnia, which I think the remake actually
1997 version, right?
1997, yeah. My issue with Insomnia is that the movie is 95 minutes long and this is one of those movies in each I think the 90 minutes actually hurt the movie.
Because you wanted it to be longer. You need.
I think I wanted it to be a tad bit longer because I felt that there were scenes missing in which plot progression actually happened. I genuinely felt that. Because like there are some dots connection within the basic logic of the narrative which I could not buy.
Yeah.
That is number one. Number two is because this is a Scandi noir, I understand that, you know, characters are supposed to be not that much expressive. They're supposed to be obtuse.
Yeah.
And I understand that Stellan Skarsgård's character was supposed to be obtuse. And I buy it. Skarsgård is brilliant, by the way, in this movie.
Yeah.
That is the one good thing about this movie. Skarsgård is absolutely brilliant in this. But he did not need to be that perverse. I understand. I understand, you know, that European movies can have edginess. Hollywood can't have edginess because we are snowflakes. I get it. I completely understand all your problems. My point is, even the edginess needs a reason, right?
I understand what you mean. No, no, I told you when you said that, I was like, maybe I need to rewatch the, I won't, but maybe I need to rewatch the 1997 version also.
Yeah, yeah, because
and I'm like, maybe it's not as, I mean, I don't like it, but I was much more appreciative of it than 2002 version, because Hollywoodization of the 2002 version to me is like on another level only.
I agree.
You can't, you know, one of those rules in the screen books where it's like you can't kill the dog on screen.
Oh yeah,
it's they followed.
The dog is dead.
The dog is already dead before they shoot the dog it is on dead. Screen. So it's like
the
safety measures.
The Scandinavian bleakness is so much that at this point in the original, there is literally the scene in which Skarsgård's character shoots the dog. He feeds him a cookie and then he shoots the dog. After shooting the dog, he literally cuts the bullet out.
Yeah,
Hollywood is such a snowflake that they showed the dog is already dead.
Like a dog killer can't be a good guy, right?
My dog killer can't be a good guy, you know.
But
the point being that they can't see him puking. Al Pacino. Maybe Al Pacino refused. But
maybe. Yeah.
You're out
Al Pacino,
of order.
Al Pacino is like, you also need to realize that this is Al Pacino of the 90s into the early 2000s. This is Al Pacino of Heat. The fact that he can't do hoorah. He can't do hoorah in this movie. I'm sure that must have cost him a lot. So he's like...
He was actually trying very hard to get out that frustration, lose his shit.
Yes,
because
yes,
he was still in his Vincent Hanna era.
Vincent Hanna
zone, wearing all that same
Jesus
pose,
Christ,
walking the same
Jesus
style.
With
the same droopy eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, even Vincent Hanna had that thing as well. But then again, he went on to had some frustration... Lose his shit in front of the victims, but he has
one or two shouts, right? And
it's very less. It's very less compared to any generic.
I know.
Heat is a vibe.
I'm actually glad.
We can have an entire episode about Heat.
I'm glad somebody else brought up Heat actually, because I was just thinking this is Pacino's character in Insomnia is what would happen if you took Vincent Hanna off cocaine.
Exactly.
Pretty much dried him out and sent him to Alaska to investigate a murder.
Yes. Who knows? Maybe that's exactly what happened. I need to read Heat 2, by the way. I don't know if Michael Mann actually loves Insomnia enough to put it in. I have no idea.
I'm missing out on something if you've not read that novel. It's quite good.
Yeah, yeah. I have been reading it. It's actually great. I was surprised. It's,
yeah. Terrific.
Back to Insomnia, Amartya.
I'm getting that. By the way, I like this movie. Just putting it out there. Before I get there, I was talking about the original, and it's like the perversion of it that, you know, Skarsgård's character being so, you know, even while he's driving, his intimacy with the young girl and everything.
Yeah, it's very icky. I remember
it
being very icky.
I understand that, you know, that edginess, that sordidness. I think that sordidness even extends to his intimacy with the receptionist, which ends.
I remember that relationship being extremely uncomfortable in the Swedish version, and it's barely there in this version.
All the
women character in this are horrible, I think, like horribly written. And you go on to this whole angle of Nolan hasn't written them, by the way. So just to like clarify that.
The point. Screenplay is the original thing. That's my whole point, right?
They're adapted by Hilary Seitz. So
yeah, you can't exactly fault Nolan for it.
Yes.
Yeah. So my point is that, okay, so the women character are horrible. I get it. Why did you need to show the perversion and sordidness again? The murder is already cruel done. The mistake is already done. How much more do you need to?
Again, yeah. I just don't. I hazy memory of 1997.
But the biggest criticism of the entire original movie which I had is that apparently because Stellan Skarsgård's character is in a city where sunlight doesn't set, he's suffering from insomnia. Bloody fuck, show me that.
But why do you
show
need to
show me that he's tired? Show me that he's tired.
Why do you need to? He looks like he's had 15 bottles of vodka and he's literally just like...
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You haven't slept for 4 or 5 days. You mean to tell me that you can walk straight?
Yeah, I mean, come on. That much, though, even in this new one is a bit... Like, in this new one, though, I couldn't buy that they're in Alaska. Like, the Alaska seemed like a tourist version of Alaska.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That I understand.
That was British Columbia. They couldn't
cheat. That's Hollywoodization. Yeah, yeah. That's Hollywoodization. I get it. But at least Al Pacino is yawning. At least Al Pacino is hitting in walls. Okay, fair enough. You know, I get that.
See, again...
Fair enough. These are the criticisms I have. Now, let's get on with the original... The new one.
No, the new one, not original.
Yeah, new one. So you guys go ahead. Then we'll talk about it. Yeah.
So then
do you remember it, Varun? Yeah. Because you've seen it like a while
back. No, I rewatched only Insomnia because Aquaman 3 is the only one I don't like.
Okay.
So you rewatched that only?
That one only. Because I was like, you need to give the film that chance, right? Okay, maybe I wasn't in a good space, that kind of thing. But I had watched it the first time in fairly decent atmospherics. It was quite cold where I was living also at that time.
It helped.
No, 4DX.
It helped. Yeah.
No
4DX experience.
4DX experience, yeah. Too much 4DX.
But I think my impression of the film reduced for my... or at least I didn't feel that I had been unfair to it the first time. Yeah. I feel that the 3 I've given it on Letterboxd is about half star too many. But it's very, you know, the only places where Nolan comes through is actually when he tries to frame his characters in the larger environment that he should
be. Landscape shots of...
Yeah, not the landscape shots because those feel like they're, you know, Tony Fisher was hired by British Columbian government to shoot a bit. It's like, you know... It's like half the films we are making in India right now. Anil Mehta raised this great point that all of our comments about good cinematography are about Switzerland and Jammu and Kashmir.
Boy, landscape shots.
Anybody can shoot
landscape shots. Yeah, landscape shots.
Exactly. So, but here I think it's when, for instance, Pacino and Donovan, the seaplane lands and Hilary Swank gets out of the car and she's walking down the gangplank and he frames her walking down the gangplank from afar. And the seaplane is in the backdrop and you can see the entire water body and everything. And I thought that's a fairly neat shot in the sense of a Nolan shot of, you know, this person and understanding the space they are in.
Yeah.
But then the rest of it is so turgid and so really... I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. You know, it's very staple. I like Robin Williams. I think it's...
I think Robin Williams, I
like
him.
It felt like he was a misfit in this film. I felt like he was a misfit in this film.
I'll tell you what I liked. I liked that they didn't make him a crazy killer. He's a man who seems genuinely convinced that what happened
was a mistake.
And he plays that element of the performance well. But when him and Pacino are going toe-to-toe, it's an uneven scene, that scene, you know?
In the boat.
On the boat, it's because it's completely Williams' scene. It's not, and I get it that Williams' character has the upper hand.
I thought on the boat scene, Pacino was literally going to fall asleep. I'm like, okay, you're acting, but are you actually going to
because it felt also, I felt Pacino was perhaps at that point already too old to be playing the character that he
Arre, there were so many cuts in this where I was like, how much do you have to cut to like show, like to cover up the fact that
that's what I mentioned. That's what I mentioned there in first.
But yeah, he can't.
So
turn.
Many
I'm sorry.
Cuts.
I'm sorry.
Irishman before
so
Irishman.
Many.
Yeah, Irishman is 20 years later, man.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But it's kind of like if they'd taken a slightly younger actor and, you know, done something with that, but for whatever reason they went with Pacino.
Stellan Skarsgård ko le lete yaar. Like he did the original.
Yeah, but again, here's the thing, right? Here's the thing. Here's my defense for Insomnia in this case, that I think interpretation is different here, right? Because if you see the original, the Hilary Swank character and the Al Pacino character in the original, they are colleagues. They are contemporaries. So the interaction between the two of them is more of a healthy competition plus a respect which turns into contempt by the Hilary Swank character when she understands that he has done the deed. That's contempt. In this interpretation, it's not contempt. For Hilary Swank, that's conflict. Because she actually looks up to him. So that reinterpretation I can buy. I felt that was a pretty smart choice in a way.
Okay.
Making Al Pacino as a much more veteran of a character who has seen a lot of shit, actually. I think that interpretation actually works in this scenario.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I just think there's barely anything given to Hilary Swank to work with. So Swank
yeah, she's
with.
Just sort of like going with it.
Hey, Hilary Swank's character was really badly written because she had no emotional arcs when she got to know Al Pacino killed this guy. She was also like, she was kind of like very submissive.
I think the conflict here was that because this is the reinterpretation, right? I think the conflict here was that she never took it as a She took it as a form of betrayal, but the conflict is that she also thinks that how can he do it? Apparently, this is a guy who
did
has
you,
not so many cases.
But did you get that impression? Like, I never got
any. I got it in the end. I got it in the end. I got it in the end. Which is why I think that this is also Nolan becoming more studio-fied and his cynicism decreasing. Because
it's his least cynical film because there's redemption in this.
Yeah,
like
the ending is the most non-noir ending I can ever
think of. I wrote Hayes quoted. Totally.
Haze coded, exactly.
Going back to the noir, totally haze coded.
It's totally haze coded.
There's
but
a moment. But what you bring? There's a moment in this when Robin Williams tells, Pacino holds the gun to Williams's face, I think, and Williams is he asks him, "Is this also an accident?" And he's like, "If you wish it to be." Which is the sort of memento idea, I feel like. This whole idea that, you know, a man is capable of doing horrible things and then deciding whether it's true or false based on his own corrupted morality.
Yeah.
But the film sort of goes on from there and then he has to have like a hero's arc and
redemption
the good thing,
and
the
everything.
Good thing about
so.
The good thing about the original is the original basically ends with their last confrontation near the hotel. You know, that confrontation which happens near the hotel. That last confrontation happens near the war in the original.
Yeah.
In which that confrontation happened, then the guy tries to escape and
he falls down or something.
And he falls
right?
down. And he
like
falls
it's
down.
Like this guy doesn't even do
it's
anything.
It's unceremonious. It's unceremonious as hell. That's the good thing I liked about that movie because that's the driest of all endings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is also so Scandi noir. I can't complain about that. Dry endings. I understand.
Yeah.
But this is like I saw that then I'm waiting. Wait, this thing is 90. That thing was 95 minutes long. This thing is 2 hours and 10 minutes. There's still 20 minutes left.
Yeah, it's about 2 hours. It's just
2 hours. It just feels
it's
2 hours.
2 hours
20.
Yeah. And I'm like, it's almost 20 minutes or more left. What else is he going to do in 20 minutes more? And then that entire shootout scene and everything. And I'm like, why?
That is the studio part of the film, right?
That is the studio part
and
of
it's
the film.
So, I'll tell you what surprised me about that. I had a comment on the Hilary Swank thing. I'll quickly make it. Has anybody watched the ABC show Castle back in the day?
Yes, I have.
Right? In that, Stana Katic's character, Kate Beckett, is
Kate
similarly
Beckett.
Betrayed by a seeming mentor kind of figure.
Her
own captain.
Early seasons. Season 4, the betrayal.
4, 5, yeah. So, it's like... I get it. It's long form storytelling, so you can do it much better. But I found that, you know, if you had done that kind of thing or tried to bring that kind of thing to the table here, the Swank Pacino situation would have worked out better. The betrayal didn't hold, you know, much
again,
weight.
It's like, it's like even if the script doesn't give you, I think it's the same thing I told Zoom during our Jubilee discussion, right? I'm just bringing this up because I'm just bringing this up for a reason that if your script doesn't give you much, if you are an actor of a high caliber, the actor should be able to take it upon himself. I don't think that Hilary Swank took it upon herself also to, you know, elevate this or anything. I'm not expecting anything.
I would say some, I would say Carrie Ann Moss does a lot with a smaller
In Memento,
part, but it's a but she makes a lot of it.
So especially really especially in Memento during that scene when she says, you know, I can do anything with you and you will not remember anything, you retard. I'm like, nice. Really nice. That's well done.
Anyway, back to Insomnia.
With the studification, you look at the credits, right? Two of your executive producers are George Clooney and
Steven Soderbergh.
I'm like, wow, okay.
Yeah. First of all, Clooney doesn't have a role in the film, which is great. Yeah. It's so rare. Every actor who's an executive producer on a film is usually
Clooney, I wouldn't have minded seeing Clooney.
I wouldn't have minded instead of Pacino. More agile.
Clooney in place of Pacino.
Also Insomnia feels more like a Soderbergh film than a Nolan film. Like Nolan, it doesn't feel like ये देख के नहीं लगता है कि नोलन ये बना सकता है. सोडरबर्ग कैन मेक दिस, नोलन कांट मेक दिस.
नो बट आई थिंक द नोलन थिंग आई थिंक द नोलन ट्रेडमार्क्स आर मोर इन द एडिटिंग,
द फ्लैशेस
इन द बिगिनिंग ऑफ द
पॉडकास्ट. द फ्लैशेस, दैट्स व्हाट आई सेड. या दैट्स व्हाट आई आल्सो सेड इन द बिगिनिंग.
या
इट्स मोर अबाउट द रेस्टलेसनेस ऑफ द फिल्म.
So
that studioification also felt like, you know, even the studio is telling Nolan, you can do your thing now, just do some parts of your thing. So when he's shooting, you know, Robin Williams' character, you know, that entire shootout, it's like each and every time the shootout is occurring, that quick editing of it all, that he's shooting and they're shooting and everything, that's like Nolan perfecting the following style, more or less.
Right.
You know? That's Nolan perfecting it. He will perfect it completely in Dark Knight. But
there was one moment which like really struck out to me, because I was honestly borderline sleeping by the end, just because I was tired. I'd watched Memento and like the third time I was watching
You watched a movie called Insomnia and you were borderline.
I know the irony. But there's this moment towards the end where like all his sort of past sins and whatever lies he's made start to like blur in front of
him.
As he's like facing Robin Williams at the shootout, and I thought that the direction of that particular scene was really, really impressive and effective. I thought, more of this, please, Nolan.
What I felt is that Soderbergh at that time had just, I think, done Oceans.
Yeah.
So he was kind of indebted to the studios that, you know,
2002,
even though,
right?
So Traffic has also just happened.
Ocean's 11 and Traffic, I think, just happened.
Like, how can Soderbergh agree to back such a staple? Because, you know, of his generation, I would actually say nobody has done more inventive things with the form
than Soderbergh.
Than Soderbergh has. Like, you know, nobody wants to sort of watch.
He's always
like
been
Logan
like
Lucky.
He's always been flitting around the India mainstream.
You want to know? You want to know how zero budget filming looks like? I'm going to show you with an iPhone.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm like, why would Soderbergh? And essentially, Soderbergh, the reason is to help put Nolan, ground
on the studio map,
LA, right? Mm. And essentially, that would lead to bigger things. But especially that ending is such a studio thing. It's such a, you know, you need to have this hero-villain confrontation.
It's also a very studio thing in that, I don't know if you caught this, it's like, Jesus Christ, the Bourne identity destroyed many thriller movies, right? Like, Christ, for effing sake, just stop with the quick cuts. I beg you.
But I think the quick cuts in this are to cover the fact that these two aren't like involved.
Aren't
in
agile young men.
Yeah, I get it, but still, by shooty to kar raha hai, itna quick cut.
It's not even like a western where, you know, you can do it.
Minor defense, though. I am a big fan of Green Grass's.
Oh, God.
Greengrass knows how to do it.
By Jason Bourne, he had lost.
No, not Jason Bourne.
By Bourne, Supremacy or Ultimatum.
Ultimatum was also a bit much. By Jason Bourne, I had checked out. I was like,
Jason Bourne was boring.
It's a boring.
Better than Tenet, though? Question mark?
No, not better than Tenet.
Okay.
Hard comparison to make. Both are horrible. Anyway.
Anything more, guys, about insomnia before we sleep off?
About insomnia? I'm surprised that so many people are defending it by saying it's one of those thrillers which people want Nolan to make, because apparently they have
because a lot of people don't like the whole Nolan complex. Not complexity, but like Nolan sometimes over-elaborate whatever.
Simplest film is his most popular film. I don't know what people are talking about. Dark Knight is the simplest
Dark
film.
Knight is a very simple... The entire Batman trilogy...
Batman trilogy is
very simple.
It's very simple.
Very simple.
What are you guys talking about?
The Nolan complexity is talked about too much. It's not. I read this book also on Nolan by this guy.
Yeah, because I think. After the Dark Knight trilogy, when Inception came out, I think it's from Inception this Nolan complex started among the masses.
I think that it's more like the hype, right?
I remember
when Inception first came out that. People were saying, oh my God, you know, it's a dream within a dream.
It's such a mindfuck.
I'm like, chill out.
It's such a mindfuck. Interstellar, even guys from my school back at that time, like, dude, do you have to watch this film?
They talk
about black hole, NASA, they got this physics and everything. I'm like, okay, but this is how Nolan films are. I mean,
they talk about
Nolan's
black holes when they are in the spaceship for the first
time.
Nolan's
intelligence didn't really cater me a lot that I would get attracted to his the directorship. But I think the fact that
Inception is basically Doodlebug, huh?
Doodlebug. I mean, I feel a lot of his ideas in Memento carry forward.
Exactly. Nolan has a lot of derivative filmmaking ideas throughout his years. But I think, Christopher Nolan, the filmmaker he is now, the popularity he has gained is because he tried to reach out the concept of intelligence and complexity to the masses in a very tangible way.
In a
very extravagant way, the thing that would cater masses, the thing a film like Primer or Coherence or a Pi wouldn't cater to the masses at
By
all.
The way, I saw Primer. By the way, I saw Primer. I seriously don't know what people were talking about. It's a very intelligent film, I understand, but it's also quite...
This is Shane Carruth.
I love that. I love that movie. I don't know why people were saying that it's the most complex film.
You are a physics student.
It isn't that complex. What the fuck?
Sir, some of us are not that
I'm happy not to
check out the guy's work
considering,
it's fine.
That's all the art versus artist debate. We are not getting
I've seen his work already, so I don't need to like re.
There are two. I'm sure you have seen his
upstream,
work.
Upstream colors very
better.
Good.
Yeah,
No. Primer is also very good. Why are we on Primer? Indie movies which sort of aren't sort of catering to the masses in some way. I've always defended films and filmmakers who kind of marry mainstream sensibility with indie sensibility.
I wouldn't say indie films, even Boy is Afraid in some extent you can say it's kind of a mainstream film, not like hardcore mainstream film.
Boys Afraid.
But it doesn't cater its intelligence to the masses.
Yes.
It doesn't make people think. It just, the entire idea of making a film like Boys Afraid is to make the...
Americans are dumb. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, continue.
People are the same dialogue in Tenet. Don't just try to understand, feel.
That's a Salman Khan dialogue. Fuck you.
Yes, that sentiment, though, I feel it's easier to follow through in a film like Memento rather than in Tenet, I feel. Tenet is so caught up in the mechanics, I find it very hard to...
Memento is actually about feeling, you know? Memento is not... Actually, feel the character.
It's more about the human condition.
His earlier films were not about the exposition. Even if you look at Inception, where he does the exposition in a walk and talk, it's still interesting. He's still doing something with it, right?
It's about the ideas.
Yeah.
For the ideas, yeah.
Where in Tenet, they first of all, if you want to do a walk and talk, I better be able to hear what the hell they're talking
about. Oh, yeah, yeah. Jesus Christ, the sound
yes.
mix is holy. Yes.
Like,
मेरे को
traffic सुनने की ज़रूरत नहीं है.
Holy crap, WB, what the fuck were you thinking?
Yeah.
And then it's about getting caught up in your own, you know, smartness that, oh, I'll get away with
no,
it.
No, it's like you've researched
explain,
without like filtering out what the research
yeah, yeah.
is.
Arya,
I'm
explain
like,
to Dhruv, right? I explained to Dhruv. I literally read an explainer on Tenet. After reading the explainer, I got confused. The movie is that bad. After reading the explainer only, I got confused.
I will say that the score, and because we've somehow gravitated towards Tenet, the score of Tenet is really sick. I really like this score.
Ludwig Göransson.
It's polarized. It's very polarized.
Oh, really? Okay.
Score,
I thought the
score
Ludwig
of Tenet
Göransson
is
score
is really polarized. Like,
okay.
Either people love it or
okay.
either people hate it so much.
I love it. I love that score.
I really enjoyed it. And I'm now wondering if Nolan sort of saw that Zimmer is going the way of
the
sort
way of Dune.
No, the way of Pritam.
The way of sand.
The way of Pritam. The way of Pritam.
Pritam basically started that music group, right? Which now, if you ever put a remix song in one of Pritam's soundtracks, he just credits the music to his music group.
Oh, wow.
Essentially, yeah.
Oh.
Whereas...
Oh, he learned from his mistakes.
Zimmer is always not reused, but like had those variations on a similar sort of track.
No, but if
oh,
you
yeah.
look at
yeah.
if you look at No Time to Die, you look at
yeah.
Steve Mazzaro's credit on that film.
Oh yeah,
it's so prominent.
It's
you're wondering how much of, because that soundtrack is very mediocre. In fact, the best piece
don't
music,
tell Sanjit that
the best piece of music in that film is from the final trailer, and that's
yeah.
not in the soundtrack.
Yeah,
and like it's such a great mesh of music.
I genuinely think the best piece of music in that entire No Time to Die are two tracks. Number one is that final track,
yeah.
you know, in which Bond is climbs up the ladder.
Spoilers
and...
for No Time to Die.
No, I'm not getting
no?
there.
Okay.
Don't worry. And
okay.
the other one is the Cuba shootout. You know that.
The good
scene
and
in
the
film.
Yeah, yeah.
The best portion of the
gun,
movie.
Gun barrel.
That movie is
gun
good.
Barrel.
It's a good movie. I will contest anybody who says it's a terrible film. I'll agree the director is a terrible human being. But art artist wala debate.
Fukunaga.
Talking
about Fukunaga.
But that was
my
thing.
My film line mein kaun terrible nahi
hai. Arre, but Fukunaga ka jo...
Abbe.
Wo aadmi dikhna chahiye na pehle. Kuch karne ke liye. बाहर तो आए गुफा से. It took him what 20 years after 20 the
years.
First film to make
yeah.
his second.
No, no,
something
second
like
film
that.
To make
his second to third, yeah. And
yeah.
Thin Red Line took 10 years to make from the time the producers went to him.
Yeah, but
the
see, the point
80s.
Is when you take time to make films, people appreciate it. Now he made three
except
films
for
in a row and people
Brody.
Started hating
except
it.
Except
so.
For Adrian Brody, yeah.
Except for it, you know. This is a joke only that people who know about Thin Red Line will get. But yes. Anyways, no more Malik, no more whatever we are discussing. Chris Nolan, back to him.
If we are going to get back on track, here's the thing. I think that his three films are the closest. I think Nolan actually touched on noir in a way.
Mm.
I think after he got into Batman...
Mm.
The noir elements were automatically there, but his Batman became more of like an industrial crime genre, right?
Mm.
So
a lot of people, what I've heard at least, is a lot of Michael Mann comparisons to
yeah, yeah, yeah.
his Batman.
Especially Dark Knight. Especially Dark Knight. Dark
mm.
Knight is very
yeah.
heat.
Dark
very Knight
heat.
Is very, very
as someone
including
who,
Roger Van Zandt. Has anybody
oh, yeah,
noticed
yeah.
that?
Yeah, yeah.
As someone who's
blue
not
color,
watched
why the blue
much...
color gritting?
I know.
The blue color
gritting. The navy,
yeah,
like
yeah.
the steel blue almost. Like
yeah, yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
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 It's very evident over there.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But
I'm
but
not
again,
I've not seen
Dark
much man
is,
much man, so
it's...
my only thing is
Heat, yeah, pretty
yeah.
much. Yeah. And Collateral.
No, no,
collateral.
My no, I was about
which
to say my
better?
Only
which
thing
one is
Manhunter.
Oh, again,
Ooh.
Blue color
oh.
grading. Blue
yeah.
color grading.
Oh, very blue.
Yeah.
Very blue.
Yeah, very blue.
Not as
again,
blue
which
as
one is
Sanjay
favorite?
Robinson.
Heat or Collateral? I love Collateral.
Heat. I don't I'm not a big I like Collateral, but
again, guys, back to Nolan.
Yeah, sorry. I think
no, we
similar to what Amartya is saying is that
yeah.
It's also Nolan at his most, okay, I'm willing to push the boundaries with
yeah, yeah, yeah.
unlikable
mm.
Characters like Pacino is so unlikable, really, in Insomnia, right? And sure, it's a beast from an earlier film, but after he becomes a part of the studio system, there is an aching desire to make these men more likable, to make
I'm going to play devil's advocate. If after Insomnia your next movie is fucking Batman Begins,
right,
how else are you going to make the character? You have to make him likable.
No, but I mean, even in sort of something like Inception or Interstellar, I would argue they are not necessarily
a Prestige.
Great man, Prestige. He's still willing to present them as
unlikable. I think Bale is pretty likable in Prestige, from whatever
the
I remember.
Alternate Bale. That's
one Bale.
Yeah, one Bale.
For other references, you may check out Doom 3.
Yes, Christ.
By the talented gentleman who shares part of his name with Amartya.
Oh, God. Please don't remind me. Please don't remind me.
And also part of his name with Dhruv.
Yes.
Oh yeah, shit.
Yes.
We face palmed so hard when we got to know Amit. So we were like, there is that one meme, na, that one black guy is laughing and then he frowns.
Yeah.
In the next slide. So we had that same reaction, like Amir Khan is the next protagonist in Doom 3.
Yeah.
It's directed by Vijay Krishnacharya. Like, why are you doing this to us? Why this guy is making films?
Doom 3 is such a blatant ripoff of both Dark Knight and
Prestige. And Prestige.
Angry. Yeah. It made me literally angry.
I laughed. That movie,
I think,
is
the only people who came away from that film with any sort of reputation were the VFX guys and the cinematographer.
Yes.
That was it.
Yeah.
And
again,
in fact,
guys,
Sudeep Chatterjee's cinematography was great.
I know,
yeah,
I made the digression, but I we need to find
you
a way to end this episode because I have no idea how I'm going to edit this together.
I think we can edit this pretty simply in that Nolan is such an accessible filmmaker that even mediocre to bad filmmakers are inspired by him. Even film bros are inspired by him to that extent. So
even
everybody,
a lot
yeah.
of film bros.
Yeah. So,
I have to digress here.
Yeah.
I read, like, so when Tenet came out, so I forwarded this review to Amosuda back then. So there was this one guy on Facebook. He wrote this opening line in his Tenet review that, okay, it goes like this. Some films are rated A because of its explicit scenes and love-making scenes, as that he wrote. Nolan films should be rated I because it requires high IQ and it makes you intelligent. Tenet is one of the most
You know what my reaction is when I read this type of stuff. My reaction is like that bully on the road. Hey, London, either ah.
Oh, look at me. I have watched the Nolan film. I'm so intelligent.
Yeah.
Than this.
Which, this is the whole, I mean, we can probably end on this note and then carry forward whenever we talk the second episode. But I feel this kind of, I'm not sure how much this chimes in with the whole Wes Anderson real thing recently. But I feel,
they diluted the entire thing.
That's what I was about
I'm
to say.
So
there's a
pissed
dilution.
Off. I'm so
there's a
pissed
dilution
off at this.
Of these films and film. I mean, because I don't think if you can reify the at least for me, the emotional impact in a Wes Anderson film, or you cannot encapsulate the whole IIQ thing by...
See, emotional impact and all the traumas that Wes Anderson films holds, it is different.
Yeah.
That I get it. You don't have to show. But when you're showing a Wes Anderson trademark or in your reel, at least study the videos, man. Watch the YouTube videos. You're doing panning shots. You're doing zoom shots.
Yeah,
I mean, people I know, I don't know, like, I might share this podcast episode to my college friends. But there is one word.
You should.
Yeah.
You should.
Yeah, because I might
they
say
hate
something.
Us. They will hate us.
Yeah, they will
not
hate.
Exactly
they,
kind.
They,
we are not
yeah,
exactly
yeah.
kind to them.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
They will kill me. Yeah. Yeah, please edit this.
I think the hilarious bit is Nolan is now known for making complex plots.
Complex
I think,
ones.
I think
making masses intelligent, feel intelligent when they watch.
But
feel
I think,
intelligent,
but I
think more so than make them.
Feel
I mean, that's
yes.
the
yeah, yeah, but I think
yeah.
but I think the main distinction here is that Nolan's aesthetic or Nolan's trademark was never that actually. Nolan's trademark was more like, how are you going to take genre properties and make them faster, make them more restless, make them show in a dimension which feels more, you know, impactful every second of every moment. It's like taking a genre picture into chunks and making sure each and every chunk feels impactful.
Yeah, a lot of his films have like that old, like a old school Hollywood edge to them. They definitely do. Because like, you know, as you mentioned, like, I mean, this episode also, whatever we've recorded, sort of the three films we talked about are noir films in many senses, right? So I feel that old school Hollywood nature to his films is there. But I feel his filmmaking, of course, is influenced by, well, he has his own aesthetic, which is influenced by a couple of other filmmakers, I'm sure. But like... But it feels like he's tapped into something, I think, mostly productive with his editing.
Exactly.
Into something.
I think that's why Memento is his most closest crystallization of his entire filmography in a way, because that is the benchmark. That is what Nolan is. It's like every second, it's perfectly paced. It's like every second of the jigsaw puzzle, everything is a short film on its own. Every section impacts you hard, each and every scene.
Yeah.
However much of a minute it is. Because that's what Nolan can do. The closest thing he did it in a studio blockbuster, again, is The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
The Dark Knight is that one movie in which he did it. Mm-hmm. Each and every impact you will remember, because each and every chunk, each and every scene you will remember.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Nolan does. It was never about the complexity of the plots. Those are the ideas.
And you get and the other thing is, if you are finding them complex, honestly, listen to the dialogue. A lot of it is told.
Yes, all of those are explained.
Yeah, his films are too heavy on exposition, but he does the job of explaining what's happening.
Yeah.
Except Tenet, I can guarantee.
Tenet is just a sound mix issue.
Silent
movie.
Silent movie.
Dunkirk.
Put intertitles in the
but
movie.
I think, I think with Dunkirk, what he does is, it's a very simple concept, right? It's like, I show you three, because that's the pace of war. At those, for the army, war is because you're moving on foot or on land vehicles. It's slower.
Here's the interesting thing. A connection between following and Dunkirk works, right? Connection between following and Dunkirk is, Dunkirk also has the same following problem. You do not need the time jumping. You don't.
That, I always struggle with that, and I need to watch it again to clarify if I can make sense of it more. Like, why do you need that?
You don't need the time jumping.
I prefer it that way.
Exactly. But because he's much more capable now as a filmmaker, before that he was in following, you actually get into the... rhythm of it more easily than in form.
A lot of people, this, I've only seen one film of this filmmaker, so I don't want to draw out this comparison, but a lot of, I think, scholars and all call his films Griffithian. This is T.W. Griffith, who made The Birth of a Nation, most popularly, and other films also, which other films which I've heard are incredibly good and don't have, well, the glaring problem that The Birth of a Nation does. So
understatement, glaring problem is an understatement.
But I mean, it's an important film regardless of it being good or bad. So
yeah, true.
Or horrible or bad also. Or horrible or whatever. It's a very important film, and I've seen that film, so I understand what people mean by the intercutting is something which is very central to Nolan's filmmaking. I think even in the films we've seen. But it kind of becomes more and more influential in other expansive films where he has to cut between actions in different places and different all that. So I think that's a very interesting influence that I think that exists there. But I think we've discussed more than enough of Nolan and a lot of other people, I think.
Nolan Noir.
Yes, Nolan Noir. But I will need to. I will. This editing is going to be hard for me. But okay, challenge undertaken. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you learned more about the films. Learned is probably not the correct word, but I hope you enjoyed listening to us talk about a lot of other films. I'll keep in some of the references we made to other films and filmmakers. I think it's what you said is correct. Like, he's someone who has had a big influence, who continues to have a big influence. For good or for bad.
Yeah, I was talking with somebody about, you know, like, somebody recently saw Spielberg's Sugarland Express and they were very impressed with Sugarland Express. They were like, this movie is incredible. Why isn't people not talking about it? Mm-hmm. Did Spielberg peak in the 70s? Mm-hmm. I'm like, with people like Spielberg and Scorsese, you can't say that they peaked in the 70s. They peaked every time in each decade. Each and every decade of them has a movie which can be considered a masterpiece.
Yeah.
I genuinely think that this is not... I don't think I'm calling this a hyperbole. Nolan has made 12, I think... 12 to...
Oppenheimer's, I think, going to be his 12th, if I'm not wrong.
Oppenheimer is going to be his 12th or 13th.
Yeah.
I think within 13 films, he has become one of the more consistent filmmakers alive. Precisely because even more than the ideas, I think his overall execution... his overall grappling of the form, it's incredible.
Anyone who I think is looking for inspiration in terms of filmmaking, maybe not incredible. Screenwriting, is like the whole distinction I feel people make, right? Yeah.
I think more than the inspiration, it's about the passion.
Yeah.
Nolan teaches the filmmakers how to be passionate about films.
Yeah.
How to love films, how to extend all the boundaries, go across all the borders, just to make your scene happen.
Yeah.
Like, go make that happen. Carpe, it's like Nolan's, to films to Nolan is mostly like his Carpe Diem moments.
Yeah.
Make it happen. Seize the moment.
But I also think that with that passion comes a sort of discipline in terms of the control he's got over making.
Tremendous control.
Now.
And it's not just studio control. That the studios have sort of gone, like, you know, do what you like, here's a $100 million check.
Yeah.
It's also the fact that people like Fincher are very keen on ensuring that, you know, because there's a lot of people who are passionate about films.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't mean they're good filmmakers.
Yeah.
They're probably better film buffs.
Ed Wood.
So, with Nolan...
Edgar Wright for a second, I was like,
Ed Wood. Don't worry. I'm not that much of a blasphemous person. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But with Nolan, you also see that Carrie, you know, it goes through. He goes through with delivering on a film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Come what may, it'll never be something that's by the books, that stick, that feels like AI, for instance. Now,
there are very few filmmakers who have this much control over their craft. The one other person whose control is impeccable is Spielberg.
I mean, no, you don't think Quentin Tarantino?
Tarantino is indulgent. I'm sorry.
I mean, okay. Fair enough.
Tarantino is extremely indulgent. I'm like, control.
Fair enough. I understand what you mean.
So... I think Spielberg is impeccable control. You can't even imagine, like, West Side Story was a revelation to me. I was like, this guy makes his first musical and he makes it like this. How do you do that unless you have control over the craft? Impeccable control over the craft. I think even Scorsese has it to a certain degree. Scorsese has it. So
all of them have also dabbled in sort of different, I mean, genres and film styles, I feel. Most of them.
Yeah.
Nolan hasn't done a romance, but I guess no one wants that also.
Nolan.
I think we'll see that in Oppenheimer.
You can make a romance. You just have to know how to write your women characters.
Yikes.
Or just
Carrie Ann Moss very good.
Carrie Ann Moss was good, but that's noir, right?
That's the high point of his, I think, writing for a woman character. Yes. Which is
he literally replaces a woman character in the middle of a trilogy and expects nobody to notice.
I mean, to be fair, that was Katie Holmes. You understand?
Oh yes, but Maggie Gyllenhaal is really good.
Maggie Gyllenhaal is
much better.
He's an improvement.
He's an improvement, 100%.
Okay. That's, I think, on that note, which is a very weird note, we should end this episode. But I don't know what note, actually, considering I am the editor of this episode. So I will decide.
So let's just start the conversation from here on.
Yeah.
Since you're doing Nolan, let's go there.
Two more hours of discussion, yes.
Yeah.
no, okay. Thank you so much for listening. I hope this has been an informative and enjoyable discussion. You can follow, I have noted this down for once. You can follow Amartya on Instagram at Amartya25. Prithvish on Instagram. Do you want me to plug Prithvish? At little.lord_font.
Fontleroy.
Yes. Okay. And we will put everything in the description. So that'll all be there. And Varun, you can follow on Cinephile Stock, right? Varun, you want me to plug that or you want me to plug
that? No, that's good. That's good for now.
Okay. And you can follow me at Terminal Cinema if you want to. You know, the weird thing, my Instagram account, like, it deleted from my phone and I can't access it now from my phone. So it's barely, basically useless. Anyways, I don't, that's TMI, I feel. anyways, thank you so much for listening. And I won't say khatam. Because
start.
Part 2,
welcome.
Let's start.
Welcome.
Let's start.
Welcome.
Welcome. So, part 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or you can do the memento.